Good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters and young people. Well, we left Josiah last evening, having responded to the words of the living God. And once he'd heard back from Huldah the prophetess, he immediately was galvanized into action. He didn't just sit and find himself depressed. He was galvanized into action and he called the people together, great and small, from all over the land, from way up north and right down south, from around Jerusalem and throughout Judah. And he read to them in their ears the Book of the Covenant. Exactly what he read, we don't know. But we can work out from what we know that it was probably some of the same words that were read to him by Shaphan. And that means that it was probably some of the latter chapters of the book of Deuteronomy, which in fact is called the Book of the Covenant or the Words of the Covenant. Now, I'd like you to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 29 to begin with, because what we want to do is pick up the story here. You remember the reason why Josiah wanted to read to the people the words which he'd heard was that he read very carefully the words of Deuteronomy chapter 30, and he knew that even now, if some turned with all their heart and all their soul and all their might, as Deuteronomy 30 tells us three times, that God would still have mercy. The nation would still go into captivity, but it would depend on whether there was any response as to whether anyone would come out of captivity again. But it was on that same day when these words in Deuteronomy 30 were spoken that Moses also said this in chapter 29 and verse 1. These are the words of the covenant which Yahweh commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. So the words that surround this chapter here, chapter 29, become what are known as the words of the covenant. And it may well have been this that caused Josiah himself to stand that day and make a covenant, as he did after the reading of the words of the law to the people. Now, this covenant that Moses made, Josiah must have read very carefully, because we find that it's not exactly the same covenant as was made in the day that they were at Horeb. Verse 1 makes that clear. But it was still a covenant that was based on obeying commandments, just like the one at Sinai. We find in verse 9, for example, "Keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do." That was one of the weaknesses of the covenant that was made at Sinai, that they just were never ever able to keep all of the words that God had penned there for them. And if they were guilty of any, they were guilty of all, as Paul later said. But you know, there was a difference between this covenant and the covenant at Horeb. First of all, there was a new generation, a completely new generation largely, who stood there that day and heard those words, because the majority of the previous generation that had stood and heard the words of Yahweh at Mount Sinai had actually perished in the wilderness. But there's more than that. Verse 12. "That thou shouldest enter into covenant with Yahweh thy God and into his oath, which Yahweh thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee as a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." You see, Moses was very clearly here in Deuteronomy 29, in this covenant that was made in the plains of Moab, very clearly foreshadowing the new covenant, which in fact preceded the old, because the new covenant was the covenant that was made with Abraham. And so he's reminding the people of a covenant that had never ever been taken out of the way. It was still in existence, even though God had superimposed over the top of it another covenant at Mount Sinai, which was to only last for a short time. But the Abrahamic covenant was to have a long term of of force that was going to eventually incorporate Messiah. You see, what Moses was trying to do was to point to the means of salvation, and that day in the plains of Moab, the people were meant to make a covenant, but to look forward in faith, not by adherence to law, but in faith, knowing that the law itself couldn't save, but that there was another covenant also in operation, the promises given to Abraham that were still in force, by which they would eventually gain life if they could faithfully adhere to all that God had said. And what Moses clearly wanted to do, and he understood, there is no doubt of that, but what Moses wanted the people to understand too, is that they needed to keep all of God's commandments in the spirit of faith. And that's confirmed for us, if you like to look later, not now, if you like to look at Romans 10, where Deuteronomy 30, the section just following this, is actually quoted. Now, Moses was therefore, to summarize, trying to show the people that it was the spirit, the keeping of the spirit of the law by faith, that's what God really wanted. And when Josiah read these words, do you think that was missed on him? A young man who'd been seeking for 10 years to find the God of his father David, and who now comes, having found the spirit of the law without the law, now comes to read particularly the words of Deuteronomy, which encapsulate the very essence and spirit of all that God had written before. Do you think he didn't see that in what Moses had said? And I believe that was the motivation for Josiah on that same day that he read those words to the people. He himself, being so moved by that, made a covenant that day in Jerusalem. Come back now to 2 Kings 23, because here we just pick up the record in verse 3 of the king now, having read these words, standing there, and he says in verse, we read in verse 3, "And the king stood by the pillar and made a covenant before Yahweh to walk after Yahweh and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all their heart and with all their soul, and to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book." Now, there's a few things we really just need to pull apart in this verse. The first thing is to notice that the words that Josiah used here are almost taken verbatim from Deuteronomy chapter 26 and at verse 16 and 17. We're not going to turn that up at the moment, but if you'd like to make a note of that, Deuteronomy 26 and verse 16 to 17 are certainly the basis of the actual words of the covenant that he framed here, that he made that day with his God. And before we go any further, I think it's worth noting that in that verse, where it says they made this covenant with all their heart and all their soul, you'll notice that the words "there" are in italics. They are not, definitely not, in the original. And it should read "with all the heart and with all the soul." And we know, by reference to the Chronicles record, where it says "with all his heart and all his soul," that in fact it was Josiah that was making this covenant, and it wasn't, as it seems to read here, that it was a combined covenant with all the people. It was Josiah's personal covenant that he made there that day. Now, you'll notice there that we're told at the beginning of the verse that the king stood by a pillar. We know that he's in the area of the house of God, because verse 2 tells us that the king went up into the house of Yahweh and all the men of Judah. So he's actually in the temple area itself. And the only pillars we know of in that area are in fact the two pillars out the front of the house that had the names Yakin and Boaz. And it says the king stood by a pillar. In the Chronicles record, it says, "and he stood in his place." Now, the names of these two pillars, you may remember from Sunday school days, the first, Yakin, meaning Yahweh shall establish, and Boaz, in it is strength. And what these two pillars actually stood for was a statement, as people came up to the house of Yahweh, of what God's purpose and intention with the nation was. It was definitely Yahweh's purpose to establish the house of David and upon that throne to establish a king who would reign forever, who would be both a priest and a king. And there in one of those pillars was memorialized that principle that Yahweh was the one who would establish the house of David. And on the other side was another pillar called Boaz. In it is strength. And it wasn't in the house of David that there was strength. It was to be in the word of Yahweh, his testimonies, which had been given consistently to the nation right from the day they were inaugurated as a nation. And now there before the people was encapsulated that principle that in Yahweh's testimonies and in his law there was strength, and that's the only strength that the nation would ever find if they trusted in all that he had said. And we find that Josiah stood by a pillar. And it's interesting to notice that there's only ever two occasions when we find a king going into the house of Yahweh and standing by a pillar. This is one. And the other one is a very interesting king that we're not going to have time to look at in detail tonight, but it was young Joash, who also came to the throne as a child, who also began his reign with very good leadership behind him, as we are very well aware. But he did a number of things that are very similar to Josiah's reign initially. You remember in Joash's reign, there was a covenant made there in the temple, Jehoiada the priest being involved in that. You will remember too that he gathered money of the people to repair the house of God, and they began to repair it, and the workmen faithfully carried out. Many of the phrases to do with the repair of the house in Joash's day are very similar to those in Josiah's day. But what is the significance of those only two instances where a king had stood by the pillar? Well, in the case of Joash, there was a young king at 6 years of age who nearly lost his life at the hand of Athaliah, you remember. In fact, she thought she'd finally got rid of the house of David. And there memorialized in one of those pillars was that Yahweh would establish the house of David. And Athaliah thought she was going to defy that. And eventually when Joash was young enough, Jehoiada the priest took him into there with all the precautions that he took and stood him by the pillar, and there he was anointed king, and they made a covenant with the people. And there, you remember, Athaliah came in and cried, "Treason, treason," and was chased out of the temple precincts and killed. Yahweh that day truly upheld the principle of Yakin. And there this young king of the line of David, the only surviving one in the line of David, was established once more by the providence of God in the nation. And now we find another young king raised up many, many years later, who of his own volition goes into the temple and stands by those pillars again. And having read the word and the testimony, which is the very essence of the other pillar, he now makes himself a covenant with Yahweh to follow him in all his ways. Let's just read those words again in verse 3. "And he made a covenant before Yahweh to walk after Yahweh and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, and to perform all the words of this covenant that were written in this book." Isn't that incredible emphasis, brethren and sisters? Because here's a young king who's put absolute trust and knows that in that there is strength. And there symbolically he's standing alongside that great tower. That theme goes on, by the way, and we haven't got time to expand upon it tonight. But this covenant that he made was clearly influenced by Moses' covenant. And in the spirit of Moses' covenant, he made that covenant that day with all his heart and all his soul. And he wanted, desperately wanted the people to catch the same spirit. Now, I believe that day Josiah, being the sort of man he was, and knowing of his response to the word of God that we saw last night, he wasn't a man that was sort of concerned about what people were thinking of him. I believe on that day when the book of the law was read to all the people, would have had a similar effect upon him as it did in the palace. He'd already heard those words. But the impact of the word of God just didn't fall on deaf ears, and it didn't cause no response in Josiah just because he'd heard it once. And nor should this word to us, brethren and sisters. Just because we've read some words before, does that mean that it can't stir our hearts again? And I think on that day, as he stood by that pillar, symbolizing where he knew the strength was, and that Yahweh had established the nation of Israel, and in particular the throne, there he is, moved again, probably, to tears. And moved to make a covenant on that day with all his heart and all his soul to serve God and to do all the words that are written in this particular covenant. And there's not a single ounce of hypocrisy here. Not a single ounce. There's no showmanship. It's just simply the heart of a very genuine and earnest man. And he deeply wanted all the people to do the same. And we find at the end of verse 3, and all the people stood to the covenant. I believe that Josiah was just such an amazing individual. His sincerity and his earnestness were just so clearly evident. He was just such an open and warm person. His response to the word just couldn't be hidden. And when on that occasion the people saw him make a covenant with his God to serve with all his heart and all his soul, they could do nothing else but also agree with the same words to do the same thing. And I don't think they were standing there thinking, oh, I suppose we better say these words. This man had so influenced them that they stood to the covenant that day. Now, as we know, time proved that they never kept it. They had too many other things in their lives. They hadn't cleared all the baggage out of their minds. They weren't ready, in fact, to make a covenant. The word of God wasn't penetrating deeply enough. But what they did see that day was a man moved by the word of God, and it started to move their hearts. Just like others in past days have been moved to tears sometimes, prostrated on the ground. You remember Saul was like that in the company of some of the sons of the prophets. When the Spirit of God evidently moved some, others around were moved to likewise follow. But unfortunately, the people were unable to sustain what they did that day. But they did see a man that day in whose heart was the law of God. And there was to be a greater than Josiah was going to come, another prophesied before his birth, the great Messiah, of whom the psalmist wrote, "Thy law is within my heart. I delight to do thy will." And when men came in contact with that man too, brethren and sisters, they were moved to change their lives. And for some it was permanent change, and for others it was only change for the moment. But they couldn't help but be affected when they came in contact with such a man as our Lord, or as Josiah here. And we find that while the people, it doesn't say that any demurred, does it? While the people actually conformed without the sword, because I don't think that was anything like what Josiah was thinking about here. He wasn't forcing people to bow to the word of God at the point of the sword, but they bowed out of deference and reverence and respect for a very great man. But it was a very great tragedy that it didn't continue. It was a great consolation, no doubt, to Josiah that Jeremiah took up the support of this covenant that was made that day. Just come over to Jeremiah chapter 11, because we find here Jeremiah referring to the covenant. And no doubt it was this covenant that was made that day. And he must have encouraged the people wherever he went to sincerely adhere to the covenant that the people had made, as well as Josiah had made on that day. In verse 2 of chapter 11. "Hear ye the words of this covenant," said Jeremiah, "and speak unto the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and say thou unto them, Thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, Cursed be the man that obeyeth not the words of this covenant, which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought you out of the land of Egypt, and from the iron furnace, saying, Obey my voice, and do them according to all which I command you. So shall ye be my people, and I will be your God, that ye may perform the oath that I have sworn unto your fathers, to give them a land flowing with milk and honey, as it is this day. And then I answered and said," and this is Jeremiah's own response, "Amen, O Yahweh." Just like the people had said in a previous time. "Then Yahweh said unto me, Proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, saying, Hear ye the words of this covenant and do them." And so he was given a commission by Yahweh to go and support Josiah and to go out around the towns and in Jerusalem to try and encourage sincerity and earnestness to the words of that covenant that had been made that day. Oh, but the terrible tragedy was, verse 9, that Yahweh came back and said to him, "A conspiracy is found among them, among the men of Judah and among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. A conspiracy. They are turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them, and the house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant which I made with their fathers." And Yahweh, as he peered down through that nation, obviously very delighted on that day when the covenant was made with Josiah with all sincerity, saw in the hearts of all the people a conspiracy. Something that was done in secret. Because a conspiracy is not something that people go out and do on the open street and tell everybody about. It's not a conspiracy, if that's the way it is. Conspiracies might eventually come to the open street, but they don't start that way. And here, there was something going on in secret. It was started in the hearts of individuals, and then it got whispered in houses and from one house to another. And they didn't really see why they should keep all of what the restrictive practices of the service of Yahweh were. Certainly they would do some, but why do we have to do all of it? And the people began to go through the motions, possibly go to the temple and to the high places. And their own lives reflected the farce that they were. There wasn't sincerity there. There was a conspiracy in their hearts. And Jeremiah was to say in chapter 3, turn back a few pages, Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 10. "And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah hath not turned unto me with her whole heart, but feignedly, saith Yahweh." Oh, it was a tragedy. And Jeremiah was down there amongst the people and he could see it. And Josiah began to see it as well. That even after that day, even after that moving day in the temple when the law was read in the hearing of all the people, and he saw the flicker of interest in the eyes of some of those who stood there that day, and a commitment on the part of the people to serve Yahweh with all their heart and soul and strength. Their heart really wasn't completely going in the same direction as his. Words had rolled off their tongues, and their heart and soul was not in it. And for a time, all must have looked fine on the outwards, but the interests of all the nation just focused in time back on all their selfish ways. You know, it was Josiah's greatest wish, brethren, sisters, and young people, it was his greatest wish that he might be able to write the law of God in the hearts of his people. And he tried that day to make a new covenant between his own God and his people, the house of Israel, the whole house of Israel. And he'd gathered them from east and west. He'd brought them all together and tried that day by his own example to lead them to make a covenant of the heart with the God of Israel. But he couldn't do it. And he wouldn't do it. He could never, ever do that nationally. And later, through Jeremiah, God revealed to him that he couldn't. Come over to chapter 31 of Jeremiah. God revealed not only that he wouldn't do it, but that he himself, Yahweh, would at a later date achieve what Josiah was unable to lead the people to do. And in verse 31, "Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah." Precisely the thing that Josiah was trying to do, to bring both houses together in a new covenant of the heart. "Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith Yahweh. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh. I will put my law in their inward parts, and I will write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know Yahweh. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest." Can you hear echoes of that day in the temple when Josiah read the law? The very thing that he'd done was to bring all Israel and Judah together that day to make a new covenant. He tried to write the law of Yahweh in their hearts, on their inward parts. And he thought to some degree he might have succeeded to begin with. He'd called from the least to the greatest. Did you know that? Notice that in verse 34. But it didn't work. And it didn't work because he actually wasn't Messiah. And that work finally would be left to the greater than Josiah, the great Yahushua himself, who would come. Because then, as verse 34 goes on to say, "For I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more." Josiah must have pleased the eternal God so much on that day, as he, with the same spirit of Messiah, had tried to do that duty. But there would be one who would come, who would give his life a ransom for many and open a way for forgiveness so that God could forgive their iniquity, and then he would write the law in their heart. And that was necessary before that could happen. And Josiah had not been asked to do that. Even though he'd tried, he would not ever be able to do it. But do you know what? He did achieve the writing of the law on the hearts of some. There were standing there that day in the 18th year a few souls whose hearts were in tune with his and with Almighty God, and upon whose hearts the law had begun to be written. And it continued from that day, even though there were later others born into his reign who had not yet heard that covenant spoken. They yet began to have the law of Yahweh written in their hearts. Well, come back to Kings, 2 Kings 23. We find here that the record goes straight on to another cleansing. In chapter 23 and at verse 4, and the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest and the priests of the second order and the keepers of the door to bring forth out of the temple of Yahweh all the vessels that were made for Baal and for the grove and for the host of heaven, and he burned them without Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and carried the ashes of them to Bethel. You know, we would have thought that that had already been done, wouldn't we? This is evidently a second purge. It's not a record of the same purge. The reason that we can be definitive about that is that the first purge, in fact, occurred in the 12th year of his reign, we read in Chronicles' record, and this occurred in the 18th. For example, if you have a look at verse 20, the end of verse 24, just picking up the words here, these things did Josiah put away, end of verse 24, that he might perform the words of the law which were written in the book of Hilkiah, the priest, that the priest found in the house of Yahweh. So this purge was actually started as a result of his response to finding the book of the law, and that only happened in the 18th year. So it's clearly a second purge. And for something like 6 years or part of it, Josiah had been around the land cleaning up all of the idol worship, and now he found that, well, some of it was back in the temple even. How did that happen? Well, I think there's two things to notice. First of all, he clearly had been inspired by the reading of the law. And there were a number of things that he found there that he didn't know anything about. And that had galvanized him into action, because here Yahweh had said that he wanted action taken against this or that, and Josiah was determined to immediately put that into action. Not just to stand there that day and to say he's going to serve Yahweh with all his heart and all his soul and do nothing about it. Immediately we find him galvanized into action, and you'll notice that he's the one that's driving all this, verse 4. And the king commanded, and we find there in verse, all the way through that section that was read for us tonight, and he, and he, and he, and he, and he. It's about 10 times through that record. Josiah is there all the way. It's his purge again. He's right there with resolve and commitment. It's part of this spiritual drive that he had to serve his God that we find this happening. Now, just hold your hand in Kings and come across to Zephaniah, the book of Zephaniah. Now, Zephaniah, you remember, was actually a cousin of Josiah. He was related to Hezekiah, but on a different line, family tree. And Zephaniah prophesied, we read at the beginning of his prophecy, in the days of Josiah. But I think we can go a little further than that and work out exactly when some of these words at least were written. Because I believe that some of these words, the ones that we're going to read particularly here in chapter 1 of Zephaniah and at verse 4, were actually written between the two cleansings, between the 12th and the 18th year. Because Zephaniah comes forth in the word of Yahweh and he says, verse 4, I'll also stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, and the name of the Chemarims with the priests, and them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops, and them that worship and swear by Yahweh and that swear by Malcolm, and them that are turned back from Yahweh, and those that have not sought Yahweh nor inquired for him. Now that's very instructive, you know, because we find that he's going to cut off the remnant of Baal. There was only a remnant of Baal left, And it must be a reference to Josiah already having done some work in cutting down the idols. But there was still some left. And we find in 2 Kings 23, in this second purge, there were still remnants of Baal left. So Zephaniah's words had come in before Josiah did the job properly, or before he'd completely destroyed the remnant of Baal. And did you notice in verse 6, them that are turned back from Yahweh? So already there had been opportunity for people to attach themselves to the worship of Yahweh, but some had turned back from that. And that's exactly what Josiah found by the time we got to the 18th year, that was the case. And there's another hint as well. You'll notice in verse 4, the name of the Kemarim. Now that word Kemarim only occurs, that particular word in Hebrew only occurs three times in the Old Testament. It occurs in Hosea, where it refers to the black frock priests of the calf worship of Jeroboam, the false priests. It occurs here in Zephaniah and in 2 Kings 23. And just come back, hold your hand in Zephaniah, come back to Kings for a second, and you'll find that in verse 5 we read, "And he put down the idolatrous priests." Look at the margin. Idolatrous, Hebrew, Kemarim. So there's the three places that this word is used, and notice what verse 5 is really saying. If we look at the marginal reference again at the start of the verse, it should read like this, "And he, Josiah, caused to cease the Kemarim." Now, they hadn't ceased in the time Zephaniah wrote. So I believe that these words are actually written in between the two cleansings. And there's still these remnants of worship. There's Malcolm mentioned here, there's the host of heaven, all of which are mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 23 and not before, as the things that Josiah now particularly was going to put his worship efforts into. Now, I wouldn't try, if I were you, to scribble all the details down off that. If you'd like to get a few little pieces, you can. But that chart in a slightly different form will be on the Bible marking sheet that will be available tomorrow night. But this is really just to summarise, and even if you can't read all the detail, it doesn't matter. Because when we look at the records of the two cleansings, by the way, the first cleansing is only recorded in Chronicles, and essentially the second cleansing is only recorded in Kings, apart from one sentence in Chronicles. So what we're looking at here in this Kings record is really not in Chronicles at all, the details of this second cleansing. And we find here that while Josiah went and dealt with the high places, the groves and the idols and so on, there's this huge list of things in the second purging that he undertook. And we might think, well, why that? It's obviously appears to be a very different cleansing and very much more thorough than the first one. It's at least on paper, that's how it seems. But you know what I think happened? Is that Josiah had been reading the book of the law very carefully. He'd found out what God actually thought about the worship of the heavenly bodies, about Tophet down in the valley, about Solomon's apostasies, which were still sitting there out on the mount. Because he found specific references in Deuteronomy and Leviticus to all of those things and what God thought about all those. And with great fervor, he now went throughout the land to remove all of these things that he didn't know anything about before. He may have thought that they were evil, but now Yahweh had specifically mentioned these in the law that had been found, and off he went to do it. But you know, I think there's something else about this whole thing. If Josiah had taken a number of years to go around and the first purge, you can scarcely imagine that all this stuff was still there. And what must have been happening was this. As Josiah moved around the land and came back to Jerusalem, as he left one town, the idols went back up again. Or the ones that he smashed and ground to powder were rebuilt again. And when he got back down to Jerusalem, did you notice something in this chapter that we read tonight? Did you notice verse 6? We're in 2 Kings 23. And he brought out the Asherah from the house of Yahweh. Do you think that stood in the house of Yahweh the whole time until the 18th year and was missed in the first purge of the 12th year? No. I think as soon as Josiah was out of the city, there was a conspiracy in the hearts of some, and those idols were reappearing. There were all kinds of... The first purge, really, Josiah taking his cue from Hezekiah's record in the Kings and perhaps Asa, who the records of which he would have had, he knocked down the images and all the high places that he could see and all the visible open things, and he dealt with those and returned to Jerusalem. But it was very different now, because he knew what Yahweh's mind was about some of these other things. Things that really were out of the eye of the king that he went looking for now. And you'll notice that there is a much, much more detailed description of the practices of the people, not just the images and the idols, but of the practices. Now that is very, very instructive, young people and brothers and sisters, to notice that there's the practices and the involvement of all these people. See, the things that are highlighted in red here are all the people that he targeted. The things in blue are all those new things that he hadn't previously known anything about. And now he went through the purge and knocked out some of the old things again, but new things were also included in this purge. But it's a purge which was mainly focused around Judah and Jerusalem. It seems that once he got into this task and really tried to follow what the law of Yahweh had said about all of these things, that it was going to be an almost impossible task to go from the north to south. This was a massive job to clean up all of this. And so he moved as quickly as he could. And as we read that thing, chapter tonight, were you amazed at the details? It almost sounds, does it not, like that chapter we read on the first study that was describing all the atrocities of Manasseh. They're all back here. The legacy of Manasseh is still living on. The legacy of Ammon is still here in the midst of the nation. Can you believe that some of these things were going on still in the 18th year of Josiah's reign? Look at verse 7. And he broke down the houses of the Sodomites that were by the house of Yahweh. The Hebrew has in. They were in the house. There were male and female prostitutes in the house of Yahweh. And he brought out all the priests out of the cities of Judah. And he went from Geba to Beersheba. And he broke down the high places. And there were these things as you came into the city on the left hand that you could go and worship. And there were priests of the high places that he dealt with, and so on and so on. And he dealt finally with the Valley of Tophet in verse 10, where the children were sacrificed, that not he might make no one to pass their son or daughter through the fire. And he also dealt amazingly with all of Solomon's legacy in verse 13. Because the high places, we read in verse 13, that were for Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had builded for Ashtaroth, the abomination of the Zidonians, and Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and Milcom, the abomination three times of the children of Ammon, this king defied. Not even Hezekiah, or Asa, or Jehoshaphat, or any of those had gotten rid of those. They had lasted all those years right up until Josiah's reign. And Josiah was not going to leave them there. Why the other kings left them there, we have no idea. But he was determined to make a thorough purge and to remove from the lives of these people all the distractions that were currently around. And did you notice there, we read very briefly in, verse 13 is one case, and verse 8 is the other. That you could come into the city, and on the left hand you could go into a high place there and worship. Or as you came into the city on the right hand, you could go to the Mount of Corruption and worship there. Or you could even go straight on to the center and you could go down to the Temple of Yahweh and you could worship there. And if you really wanted to, you could go left, right, and center. And that's what most of the people were doing. It's just an interesting little allusion, isn't it, here? Because the way the king's record begins is that Josiah was a man who deviated not to the left or right. And he saw the people deviating to left and right, and he put all his energy now into removing those distractions which were to left, right, and center, all around them. But brethren, sisters, and young people, we've got a chapter here that's just full of all this detail that just about defies description and our imagination to conjure up how this could all be back in the nation still after all that this wonderful king had done. And why is God seen fit to record all that detail? Why didn't he tell us in two verses that Josiah just went round and did another purge and cleaned up all the idols again? Why not? Well, we should ask ourselves questions like that. Of what relevance is it to us to know all this detail? And when you stop and think and you cast your mind back across what we know of the history of the nation prior to this time, there's a couple of things that will stand out. When we look back across their history, idolatry of this kind, though it was reaching its peak, idolatry had dogged the nation from its very inception. And eventually it was idolatry that caused them to go into captivity. The northern nation had already gone because of they'd followed the ways of the nations and adopted all their idols and all their practices, and that eventually gone into captivity. And now Judah is following down the same track. And from the very first day of the inception of the nation at Sinai, it had all begun. You remember at Sinai, there Yahweh, as he gathered the people out across the Red Sea and brought them to his mount, and he stood them there that day and he said, "Now prepare yourselves, because Yahweh is going to come down on the mount." And that day the nation heard the voice of Yahweh boom through that valley, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt make unto thee no graven image." They were the first words that they'd ever heard from the living God, and they were some of the few upon the earth who have ever heard the voice of God. And the first two commandments were about idolatry. Moses went up to the mount to get the rest of the law because the people had said, "Don't let God ever speak to us like that again." They were absolutely terrified. "Don't ever let him talk to us again," they said. "Moses, you go up the mount and get it. Come back and tell us, and anything he says we'll do." So Moses goes up the mount. 40 days later he comes back, and what's going on down the bottom? They've got a golden calf and they're down worshipping it 40 days later. After having been scared out of their wits at the voice of Yahweh booming through there on the very issue that they've now fallen on. And from that day, it never left the nation. And they went into captivity because of it. And now we've got another whole chapter of this stuff. Why? Why has God seen fit to record all this detail? You know, when they came into the land, eventually after a generation had been lost in the wilderness, Joshua, at the end of all his campaigns and near the end of his life, gathers the people together to Shechem. Do you know what he said? He didn't say, "Prosper and enjoy yourselves." He said, "Put away the idols and the strange gods that are among you and incline your heart unto Yahweh." God had given them a land flowing with milk and honey. What had they done? They'd learned all the ways of the heathen that he'd warned them about before they got in there. And they're now prostrating themselves to gods of wood and stone. It's unbelievable. The period of the judges was an utter disaster. Then we come to the period of the kingship. And the first king was a disaster, and David comes onto the throne as a man after God's own heart and straightens all the nation out and follows his son, who brings in abominations that are still there in Josiah's day, and they never ever left the nation. The nation divided with Jeroboam the son of Nebat making them to sin with his idols, and the southern kingdom with all their idols, and away it went for the next 400 years until they went into captivity. That's the story of Israel. From God's point of view, it was like a cancerous disease that they just could never, ever extricate from the nation. And now Josiah, enthused by the law that he's found, and here's what Yahweh thinks of this, goes forward to try and put out a bushfire. There was no way he was ever going to even make a dent on the nation. But it didn't stop him trying. He moved out amongst that nation with great zeal, trying to tell the people what the issues were. But you know, brothers and sisters, what we have in this chapter tonight in Josiah's life is the attempt of a man, a very brave and courageous and faithful young man whose heart had been touched by the word of God, to tackle the most serious and most persistent problem in the history of the nation. This is the big issue of Josiah's life. It's what he fought against from the very earliest times in his life. He struggled with it all his life. And when he died, it was rampant. And God took them off into captivity to try and forever get idolatry out of their system. Because despite the godly king that he was, despite all the qualities that he had, despite all the efforts that he made, he was unable to get idolatry out of the midst of that nation. Well, of what relevance is that to you or me? Well, it ought to be very relevant, brothers and sisters and young people. Because if God has filled half the Old Testament with historical details through the prophets and the history sections of the Old Testament, with the detail of his nation as they battled with idolatry, and this book has been written for our learning, if we don't find the key to all this issue and find what Josiah tried to do, then we're missing the point of much of God's revelation. Well, we've got to go to the prophets to find the key. Come to Ezekiel to start with. Ezekiel chapter 8. Because here Ezekiel exposes the very roots of idolatry and gets to the essence. Ezekiel was given a vision. In fact, he was taken by the hair, lifted up, and he was taken. We find in verse 3, and he put forth the form of an hand and took me by the lock of mine head, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven and brought me to the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looketh toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy which provoketh to jealousy, the idol in the temple. And we read in verse 7, and he brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And he said unto me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I digged in the wall, behold, a door. And he said unto me, go in. Go in, Ezekiel, and behold the wicked abominations that they do. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping thing and abominable beast and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. And there stood some of the 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel, and in the midst of them stood Jaazaniah the son of Shaphan. Every man with his censer in his hand, a thick cloud of incense went up. What was all this about? There was this secret door. He dug a hole in the wall and went inside the house, and he saw all this filth on the walls, all these creeping things, and he was horrified by what he saw. And then he's told, verse 12, and he said unto me, Son of man,
Hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the chambers of his imagery. What he saw on that wall, brethren, sisters, and young people, was the minds of the ancients of Israel. And graphically on the wall were the pictures of the things they were thinking about. Oh, what a terrible picture that was. Verse 14. And he brought me into the door of the gate of Yahweh's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz and all her pleasures. What an incredible thing. Ezekiel was shocked. Verse 16. And he brought me into the inner court of Yahweh's house, and behold, the door of the temple of Yahweh between the porch and the altar were about 5 and 20 men with their backs towards the temple of Yahweh and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun towards the east. What a disaster this was. What was Ezekiel being told? It was the thinking of the people of Israel that was the big problem. And all these images on the wall in that house that he saw were like looking into men's minds. And the people had got to the point of seeking after all the pleasures and forsaking Yahweh. You know, externally, young people, there was idols in the land. But the real problem was in the heart. It was the images on the mind. They were all geared to the basic lusts and self-gratification. All the idol images that Ezekiel saw on that wall that day were all about the pleasures of those people and the evils that they were up to. And all the image of the idol actually did was re-excite their minds again. It was just a reminder of all those evil things, and they flooded into their minds again. You know, in Israel, young people and brothers and sisters, the bits of wood and stone were nothing else but prompts for the mind. And the problem for all that time of Israel's history is that there were things written on their minds inside. Jesus said, out of the heart, out of the heart of man proceeds. Now you listen to this. Evil thoughts, adulteries, fornication, murder, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within, said Jesus, and defile the man. And that's what Ezekiel saw that day. He saw inside the mind. And it was a terrible picture. You see, all the idols, the actual physical idols, and all the practices that they did came from inside and out. It wasn't that they went and worshipped an idol out there. The idol came from inside. In other words, the idols were in fact just an image of their own minds. And that's the very reason why Josiah, for all his life, struggled to combat that problem, was never, ever able to. He could go to Bethel and he could smash down the altars and the high places and grind them to powder and cast them on the graves of those who'd sacrificed all manner of things. He could go down south, he could go north, he could go east and west, and he could do it until the cows come home. And look what happened when he came back. It was all there again. The reason? Because it was in here. It was in their minds. So as soon as he went away, they built it, put it back up again. They pulled it out from under the bed. They got it from the cupboard or wherever they'd put it. And it all started over again. Come over a few pages in Ezekiel chapter 14. Verse 1. Then came certain of the elders of Israel unto me and sat before me, and the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their heart, and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face. And should I be inquired at all by them? There were men who came to seek what Yahweh's opinion might be, what Yahweh's purpose and will might be, by coming to the prophet. And Yahweh forewarned Ezekiel and said, these men have got idols in their hearts. Do you think that I'm going to be inquired of by them while they've got an idol in their heart? No! Three times in this chapter he says that. In verse 4 and then again in verse 7. There was an idol in their heart that had estranged them from God, and God wasn't going to listen. Not for one moment was he going to countenance the face of those men who put the stumbling block of their iniquity in their hearts, and an idol there planted and thought that God was going to talk to them. What nonsense! Here was the real problem of Israel's idolatry. It was idolatry of the heart. And you know, young people, what God wants above all else is your heart. He wanted the hearts of everyone in Israel. He wanted a humble heart that he could work with and develop and build into a character that he could take into eternity. But they'd planted an idol in it. And don't think we can't. You know, Moses came with the words from Yahweh and said, what Yahweh really wants is for us to love him with all our heart and all our soul and all our mind. And idolatrous worship robbed God of the very thing that he wanted. The only thing he asked of his people. No doubt and no wonder his jealousy came up in his face as he saw another, a lump of stone and a lump of wood and a pleasure over here take the place of him, the Almighty who'd created all things, who'd extended himself to Israel and given them great blessings and promised them the world. And they chose a lump of stone and their own pleasures instead of him. No wonder he got jealous. But what's our idolatry? Human nature hasn't changed. We've made it the same stuff as all of those in Ezekiel and Jeremiah's day. God hasn't changed either. What he wants is the hearts and the minds of individuals. And if that's the case, young people, brethren and sisters, there is an awfully serious warning in the words and the life of Josiah. Because idolatry is the most persistent and serious problem we will ever encounter in our life in the truth. It never ever left the nation of Israel. It was always their most serious problem. And God has recorded this detail that we, upon whom the ends of the world have come, might learn. Well, what are our idols? You know, the other evening we spoke very briefly about an idol being anything that takes our affection or our time or our energy or devotion to God. It robs God of those things. It's true. I suppose the best definition simply that we could give of an idol is anything that robs God of our heart. And in outward expression, that may be all kinds of stuff around us. It could be as simple as our possessions, our cars, TV, pleasures that we like, all manner of things that we involve ourselves in that rob our time and our devotion to our God. But we've got to get a little closer to home than that, because it's just too easy to rub that off. I'd like you to let the New Testament tell us what idolatry is. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And at verse 6. Now these things, said Paul, and the context of these words is the wilderness generation failures, these things
who were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Where those words are quoted from, you'll see in your margin, they're cited from Exodus chapter 32 and verse 6. So he says, don't be idolaters like some of the wilderness generation, because they sat down to eat, drink, and rose up to play. If you were the Apostle Paul, would you have chosen that particular verse from the story of the golden calf to show that Israel were idolaters? Because I certainly wouldn't have. I would have picked a verse that said they built a golden calf, or they made Aaron build a golden calf, and then they bowed down to worship it, and something like that. But you know, the Apostle Paul knew more about idolatry than we do, because he picked the perfect verse from Exodus chapter 32 to prove that they were idolaters. You see, the real issue of idolatry was not the calf at the foot of Sinai. It wasn't the physical image that was the problem. It was the practices. It was the pleasures, it was the things associated with that. And as soon as those people saw that calf, they immediately remembered all the wonderful things, all the illicit things, all the things they weren't allowed to do that came from Egypt. And they enjoyed all of those things. You see, the golden calf was the god of fun and pleasure and dancing. And so what happened is the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. This is really the issue of idolatry, because they gave themselves to the practices of this god, and that proved that they worshipped those gods. You know, idolatry is inevitably, in every single case, it involves the elevation and the gratification of the flesh and the worship of self. And hence, to eat and drink and rise up to play, Paul says, is idolatry. You know, Jesus sounded exactly the same warning. Exactly the same warning. And he aimed it at no other generation but ours. Because at the end of the Olivet prophecy, recorded in Luke 21 and verse 34, which you don't need to turn to now, Jesus said, and it was in a context of him about to leave the earth and go to heaven, just like Moses had left the plain to go into the mount to receive the law. He said, take heed, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting, which is overeating, and drunkenness, which is overdrinking, and the cares of this life, which is a rising up to play. And if you are preoccupied by those things, just be careful, because the generation just before he would return down from the mount was given that warning. That's serious, because it's our generation. There would be a preoccupation with eating, drinking, and pleasures. And if that's not our world, I don't know what it is, especially the Western world. Oh, but Israel down on the plain, they justified all their actions. They said, well, this is only a representation of Yahweh. When Moses came down and smashed those tables of stone and said, who's on Yahweh's side? And the Levites went out and cleaned some of them up, they thought differently. They stopped their self-justifications when they realized that God meant what he said, and all they were doing was thinking over things in their mind, which were only just excuses as to how they could allow their own pleasures some reasonable right. What nonsense. And Moses took swift action. And the Apostle Paul, after listing a number of things of warnings for our generation, comes down in verse 13 and says this, there hath no temptation taken you as such as common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. The summary of all those verses He comes back to idolatry because it was going to be the most serious, persistent issue that they would have to face. It's the main issue. It will encroach our lives. It will chase us, brethren and sisters. And Paul's words are, flee. And if we stand still, it'll catch us. And sometimes we even run right into its arms. Turn over a few pages to Ephesians chapter 5. Verse 3. Fornication, all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named amongst you as becometh saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather the giving of thanks. For this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. We might like to get a rubber and just rub some words out. We would agree that no whoremonger or unclean person hath any inheritance in the kingdom of God. But whether we also can agree that no covetous man, who Paul says is an idolater, is another thing. The word covet here means the will to have more. It's always used in the New Testament in a bad sense, always. And it just describes a basic want for more. More money, more pleasure, more power, more everything. That is idolatry. And it's now a little too close for comfort, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Far too close. Yeah, Jesus had a man come to him and say, look, my brother is really trying to do me out of the inheritance. We should have this split 50-50, and he's taken it all. Can you tell him, Lord, to go and give me my other half? You know what Jesus said? He turned around and told him a parable about covetousness. And he said, in essence, that man who took all was covetous, and you who are out to stand up for your rights and get every single last cent that's owed to you are no different. And he told him the parable of the barns. You know the parable of the barns. The man did plentifully, and his field grew lots of crops, and he brought it all in. He said, I've got nowhere to put all my stuff. I'd better make some more barns. And he kept making bigger. Oh, look at all this that I've got. And the whole record is I. And God took him. He said within himself, in his heart, I take leisure, build this, get bigger, get more. That's covetousness. And that's idolatry. And that man had an idol in his heart. The idol of self, so big that God couldn't get in. You know, the prophets talk endlessly about the process in which idolatry comes into the lives. But without us having time to really go into all of those things, it is worth, brethren and sisters and young people, when we're doing our readings from now on in the Old Testament, to take very close note, particularly as to what the prophets say, about this issue of idolatry, because it's the most serious and most persistent problem that ever dogged the nation. And you know what Jeremiah and Ezekiel both said? They said that the root cause of idolatry really was covetousness. They put their finger on exactly what the Apostle Paul did. So the Apostle Paul didn't just make up in Ephesians 5 that a covetous man is an idolater. He got it from the Old Testament. He got it from the prophets, because they said that was what was the case. Jeremiah said in chapter 8 and verse 10, from the least of them to the greatest, everyone's given to covetousness. And could you say that of our society today, brothers and sisters?
Well, it's pretty close, isn't it? Mammon, the god of this world, has captured the imaginations and the hearts of people. More greed, more, more, more. Look at the huge shrines to Mammon. The huge Westfields. Just shrines to Mammon. Go in and, you don't need anything. Go in and browse around. Look at all the flashy stuff and you might find something that you might want. Isn't that covetousness? Isn't that a shrine to covetousness? They're not places we just should wander into. You know, it was only 18 months ago I was in New Zealand, and in the newspaper at the time, it said the number one pastime of New Zealanders, this was in Christchurch in the South Island, the number one pastime of people in that city, the things that they just liked to do with their spare time, was cruising the malls. Who's the god of this world? Who's got people in their clenched fist, if it's not covetousness? Come back to Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 30. Also, thou son of man, the children of thy people still are talking against thee. The margin's correct, of thee. They weren't talking against him, they were talking about him. By the walls and in the doors of the houses, and they speak every one to his brother, saying, come, I pray you, and hear what is the word that cometh forth from Yahweh. They were pleased to hear what Ezekiel had to say. They were encouraging each other to go and listen to what Ezekiel said. And they come unto thee as the people cometh, and they sit before thee as my people, and they hear thy words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goeth after their covetousness. And lo, thou art unto them as a very lovely song, one that hath a pleasant voice and can play well on instrument. They hear thy words, but they do not do them. Oh, that's serious, isn't it? There's a real issue we've got to face. A fundamental problem of the heart. What that means is that we could be just the same as the people in Ezekiel's day who actually enjoy going and hearing the word of Yahweh. We like to go and hear a good talk. We get quite excited and even talk about it. And we go away and not one whit changes. Now there's the ultimate test of idolatry. If we are reading our Bibles and we are going to meetings and nothing changes, do you know why? We've got an idol in our hearts and we don't know it. Because this generation that came before Ezekiel had no idea they had an idol in their heart. They thought that God should have been pleased with them. They were enthusiastic, they were interested. They came along and they enjoyed what was going on. And they went away and nothing changed because their heart just went sailing on after their own covetousness over all the other things that they wanted in life. Isaiah said in chapter 44, a deceived heart has turned him aside, so much so that a person who made an idol and chopped down a tree and used part of it to cook his meal and part of it to warm himself on a fire and part of it to build an image was so deceived that he couldn't even look at all of that and say, there's something wrong here. So deceived are those who become involved in idolatry, including covetousness, that they don't know they're deceived. That's a worry, isn't it? Because for generation after generation after generation of Israel's history, there were deceived hearts aplenty. You know, objectively, it's not difficult to see the issues of idolatry. You can look at a lump of stone and say, well, it's clear that that's got no power. I mean, it's really not a god, is it? Why would you ever want to serve that? But you know, the people involved in that couldn't say that, because to them it had an association and it was enjoyable. And for us, it's easy to look at covetousness in our own lives and say, well, yes, we don't really want... really, we say, we're not here for here and now. We're not here to build our empires. And we're all guilty, brethren and sisters, of putting our roots down and forming attachments in this life. And I'm as guilty as you are. And this penetrates my heart. And it's got to, brethren and sisters, it's got to affect us. Unless we want to leave the idol there. Oh, it's so easy to justify ourselves and to confuse our needs and our wants, and we can convince ourselves even if we can't convince other people. And clutter our lives with all sorts of multiple idols. But you know, brethren and sisters and young people, the real challenge is this. That if we walk away from this series of studies, and in particular this man's life, Josiah, unchanged, I don't believe we've come to grips with the whole issue of what he was fighting. Well, how do we deal with it? What do we do practically? How are we going to go about just even working out whether we've got idols in our lives and what are we going to do about it? Well, I think there's two sorts of idols. There are physical idols and there's the idols of the heart. The physical idols were like the images that were outside all around in Josiah's day. All they were was prompters for action. They were distractors of the mind and they led people's mind to do other things. There's plenty of those around us. And we can't get rid of some of those, but there's some we can. And Josiah knew how to get rid of them. He just pulled them down, smash. Ground them to powder and threw the powder away. Because if we just move it from the lounge to the garage, or from one room to the next, or put a blanket over it, or do under the bed, you know what's going to happen? It's going to come back to bite us. Josiah knew how to deal with idolatry. We've got to be honest, we've got to be ruthless in our own lives and deal with it. But that's not the hard bit. That's the easy bit. The hard bit's the idols of the heart. And really, idolatry boils down to a matter of the heart. It's what happens in our minds that's really important. It's here that we need to smash those thoughts and images and desires that actually prompt the idols in the first place. We're bombarded every day. We walk out into this world and all around us is, you need this, have this. We're just taunted by covetousness. Every time we walk into that environment, we've got to try very hard to do something about that. We've got to live in this world. We've got to make some clear discernment about what are idols and what aren't, and make sure that we're not self-deceived. And in conclusion, I'd like you to come over to Paul's words in Corinthians, because he's got some advice for us about idols of the heart. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Then verse 4. For he says, verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. It doesn't matter what is raised up. We have the power through God to pull down anything, just like Josiah did. And he goes on, casting down imaginations or reasonings and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Anything that might set itself up in our hearts, brethren and sisters and young people, as an idol, and we're able to bring it into captivity, every thought to the obedience of Christ.
We've got the weapons, we've got the power at our disposal to pull down these idols and to overcome them in our minds. And you know what? Josiah knew how to do that. Josiah didn't just go around and pull down the physical idols. He was a much more marvelous man than that. He'd actually dealt with the idols of the heart in his own life. And you know, young people, don't ever, ever walk away from this man's life without realizing that he came to grips with the most serious problem that Israel ever had, and he overcame it in his life. And the record of his life stands as a mighty testimony as to how to do that. And what he did was to write the law of heart of Yahweh in his heart every day. And by that means he enthroned not his own covetousness, not a lump of wood and stone. He enthroned Yahweh himself in his own heart. And his life was focused out upon the building of the house of God. And not for one moment did that man ever have any desire to go to a high place. He had no desire to go to a picture theater. He had no desire to go to any of the Canaanite ways at all. Because every day he read from his own copy of the law with a desire to know and to love Yahweh his God with all his heart and all his soul and all his strength.